This week on Video Culture, we'll talk sci-fi horror with Event Horizon and David Cronenberg's The Fly.
Did you rewind it?
I don't know.
In a time where everyone has a podcast, in a place where everyone has an opinion, two heroes, Matthew and Ryan, against all odds, are here to save your movie viewing experience from total disaster. Your trip through the video aisles of yesteryear begins now. There will be chills, there will be thrills, and there's a good chance that Ryan will have a coffee spill. They'll discuss the quality, cultural significance, and more detail, frankly, than you bargained for. Here's your host, Ryan Acree and Matthew Essery.
All right, and thank you once again for tuning in to the Video Culture Podcast. I am Ryan Acree.
And I am Matthew Essery.
And man, oh man, do we have two really fantastic, wonderful movies today. First off, how are you doing, Mr. Essery?
I'm doing very well, Ryan, and how are you doing?
Did you have a good couple of weeks there?
I did. It was an eventful time off. I watched a lot of movies, and that's what I do. I can't say that I watched anything that was quite as interesting as we watched for this.
All right. Well, let's just get into it. The two movies that we have today, and I'll go ahead and say what the connection of these two movies are, is that they are sci-fi horror movies, and they're both, one is really from the mid-80s, and one is kind of from the mid-90s. Mm-hmm. Now, to me, they are both sort of horror films that are essentially, and I see, sorry, you had a piece of paper you were just crumbling up and just throwing away. Like, that's okay.
I'm just putting it away for when I need it for later.
All right. I just didn't want to, I wanted to let the audience know what noise they were hearing. But no, these movies are two wonderful, I mean, I really liked both movies. One is, kind of a little bit better than the other one, but...
Well, that often happens. It's very rare that we get two movies of equal stature on this podcast. I mean, that's really kind of, it's rare. It's rare.
Yeah.
But both these movies are good, and then they have good and bad points. Just one is probably a little bit better than the other one.
Well, yeah.
Maybe that's an understatement. But I think both movies have merit.
Right.
And let's see here. Well, let's just go into what the movies are. The first movie we're going to talk about today is from the mid-90s.
Right.
It's Event Horizon, starring Sam Neill, Lawrence Fishburne, and a cast of other character actors.
Right. And the other movie is The Fly, starring Gina Davis and Jeff Goldblum.
True.
Now, I will say for both of these movies, okay, just to kind of get this out of the way, even though that they're sci-fi horror, and just watching these movies, I felt that they were more horror movies that had a sci-fi element to them, rather than they're sci-fi movies that also have a horror sort of element to them. I mean, they're really horror movies at the core.
Yes, they are horror movies dressed up in sci-fi clothing.
That's a very... See, this is why... You're the writer, and you're like the poetic guy with your words there. Yeah.
But I can't crumple paper quietly.
That's okay. I got paper in front of me too.
You know, I can double up on that. And the audience at home doesn't realize this, but I like to talk with my hand, so I will crumple paper when I need to reference the paper. But when I like to talk and just wax poetic about films, I like to talk with my hands, as I am doing at this moment.
That's right. So don't put anything in your hands. I didn't know this. Now, I'm just learning this now, actually. All right. So the first movie that we'll talk about is Event Horizon. Mm-hmm. This was from 1997? Yes,
1997. Directed by the not-so-great Paul W.S. Anderson, the less talented of the Paul Anderson directors.
All right. Not to be confused with
Paul Thomas Anderson, who makes really, really good movies.
They're not related at all, are they?
No, no. Definitely not. It's just a coincidence. Paul W.S. Anderson is the guy who directed the Resident Evil movies, the majority of them.
Right.
And he did the Death Race remake with Jason Statham. And a lot of other kind of mediocre science fiction films. Event Horizon is probably his strongest film.
Well, he basically did... This should have printed and it didn't print. I have to pull it up on my phone.
Okay.
No, the biggest movie that he did before this was Mortal Kombat.
He did Mortal Kombat. That's a pretty good movie too. I mean, it's not it's not amazing, but it is fun.
Right.
Well,
I mean, that was the whole deal. If you want to get into like my details later, that's a sneak peek. Is that he was looking for a project to do after Mortal Kombat, and this is where he went with it. So, Event Horizon is basically it's set in the future. Mm-hmm. It's a sci-fi movie where you have this sort of ragtag group, right? Mm-hmm. Where they are set up on this secret mission to go locate this craft that is on the edges of space or yes. Neptune, mm-hmm. and called the Event Horizon. Well, mm-hmm. 7 years ago, they were all told that it blew up mm-hmm. Unexpectedly. But then they get on this ship on this mission. Sam Neill plays Dr. Weir, who is like the guy who built this big ship.
Yeah.
And then they get into some sort of like stasis where they're like in water where they can travel like really fast. Yeah. And
it's basically aliens. It's basically the alien tech where it's kind of like a grimy lived in future.
Right.
And they basically go into pods like they do in the alien films, but they put them in like an embryonic state where they're kind of floating in liquid to make the trip not be as taxing on them. I think it says it takes them 60 days to get there.
But, yeah, 50-something or something.
But basically, the Event Horizon, just to kind of sum it up, it's meant to travel faster than light speed.
Right.
But it does that by going through, basically tearing a hole in dimension space to get to its destination faster.
Right. And what Dr. Weir explains to them all is like the ship disappeared, and they don't know what happened to it, so that they go on board to try to figure out what goes on. And what they figured out is basically like, where it went is like this portal to hell, essentially.
Basically, I think one of the characters refers to it as hell. You never know exactly what it is. It's sort of a Hellraiser type dimension. To use another reference to kind of qualify this film, it's kind of a hodgepodge of a lot of different ideas.
It is. It really is. It's a hodgepodge of The Shining.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where it's a hodgepodge of Hellraiser. Because there's this like second dimension where like just all about chaos happens. It's like, and it is kind of like Aliens too, where they go to a ship and then something's really bad and it kills off almost everybody, but only a few like survive.
Well, and they're basically blue collar space people, you know, like they're very much like your working Joe space person. So here's what I thought of Event Horizon as I was watching it. This is my take on it. It is a haunted house in space.
That's exactly right.
It is a haunted house film.
Right.
The Event Horizon might as well be The House on Haunted Hill.
But it's set with a sci-fi.
Yeah.
It's dressed in sci-fi clothing, as you put it. Yeah.
Like, I mean, Sam Neill's character, Dr. Weir, could have easily been played in the 1950s by Vincent Price. I mean, it's very much that kind of movie. It's a spook house film.
Right.
It has some gore. It has some jump scares. But at its core, it's a haunted house. But the ship looks like no other alien ship, no other spaceship you'll ever see. Like, I don't know why William Weir would make a ship that looks so gothic.
Right.
Like, everything is like spikes and kind of rusty looking. And
yeah.
And like when the door is closed, they have like teeth on them for some reason. Like, why would you have that? There's like this gag in Galaxy Quest where they're running through the ship in Galaxy Quest and they're like, who would design this way? This is so impractical. Well, that's the ship from Event Horizon. It is incredibly impractical.
Yes, it is. It has a lot of like weird, Yeah, sort of deco. I mean, even the deck that they have to, like, hang out in doesn't even look like a ship. There's all these weird curves, yeah, and it just looks, like, really odd. Like, where are they even at?
Yeah, it looks really uncomfortable. Like, I can't imagine, like hanging out there, like, trying to do my job.
Yeah.
You know, with, like, these weird, like, spiky, like, furniture things all around and, mm-hmm, like moody lighting, like...
Right.
I mean, even when they show, like, the crew celebrating, like, they see footage of the crew before some of the bad stuff happened and, like, the crew they're going to save, and they're, like, doing their jobs, but the ship still looks totally creepy around them. Like, I can't imagine, like, trying to do my office job at a place that basically looks like a medieval castle, you know?
Yeah.
I want to file papers while the spooky thing is directly behind me.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean... I remember watching this as a kid, and I watched it, like, on VHS. Mm-hmm. And I remember just blown away by, like, the science and all that kind of stuff. Now, I remember this movie came out the same year as the movie Contact. And it I did. Think I remember seeing Contact in the theater, mm-hmm, and then realizing that this movie also existed, which both movies, you know, talk about this sort of portal and folding space-time and all this kind of stuff. They deal, yeah, with all these, you know, Carl Sandburg, like...
You mean like...
I mean, not Carl Sandburg.
Carl Sagan?
Carl Sagan, excuse me. Don't confuse those two.
Yeah.
All these Carl Sagan concepts,
yeah,
you know, of you know, time warp, time travel, or whatever. Yeah.
And they couldn't approach it from two more different angles.
Yes.
Well, like in Contact, it's almost Spielbergian and
yeah,
kind of...
Where it's
kind
very of, realistic
yeah,
type.
Yeah, but it's kind of presented in almost a romantic way. Like, it's right, it's mystical and kind of wondrous. And in Event Horizon, it's like, you know, it's all forbidden and wrong, and, like, just the thought of it's gonna enough to make you go crazy.
Right.
So, yeah, basically, so the crew's on the
where
ship.
Where one is, like, sort of PG, yeah, and the other one's, like, rated R.
Yes.
You know, like, this is totally separate.
And speaking of this movie being rated R, it is incredibly violent.
Yes.
Like, I was actually surprised. I'd seen it when I was younger, back in the days of VHS, and I'd forgotten just how gory the film was.
Right.
Like, it surprised me. Like, people really get messed up in this film. Like, I mean, there's, like, gooey practical effects. I mean, it's not anything near what the movie we're going to talk about is. But
right,
still, I mean, there's some real nice practical, like, gory effects in this film.
Right. Well, I will say some of those are flashed on the screen really fast.
Yes.
So you get a flash of it. And especially when they show, you know, the scenes of the past crew, because they had, like, a
yeah,
video of, like, what, you know, what sort of happened, you know, the past yeah, logs or whatever.
Yeah.
And, but yes, like, what happens to how Dr. Weir, like, transforms and there's...
Did you think
eyes where the eyes don't exist?
Yeah,
and,
did you think they called him weird because he ends up being weird?
I mean, I think that's kind of obvious, right? I mean,
we're bringing on the subtext for you, people.
Well,
hot takes.
But here's the problem that I kind of had with the movie. Okay, you, Dr. Weir goes in. I mean, he's kind of like the ship is calling him back or whatever. And he kind of becomes the villain, but really the whole time the villain was the ship. Like,
yes,
he was the one that had, like, the weird, like, dream about his ex-wife or whatever who
yeah,
killed himself. But then he winds up being the kind of, like, yeah, the villain in charge.
It is very much like The Shining, to go back to the haunted house analogy.
Yeah.
Like, he's kind of possessed by the ship, but I kind of have the impression he was kind of crazy before he ever got owned to the ship.
But everybody else that's crazy, they wind up, like, killing themselves, or like the one guy who sticks his, like, hand in the thing,
yeah,
right, in the water. He winds up just, you know, that gets into the coma.
See, that's what's that character's name? I know who you're talking about. That is that that's Jack Noseworthy, who played Ensign Justin, I believe.
Yeah.
What
so, a, Justin, yeah.
Okay, I got to pause for a second. His last name is Noseworthy.
This is terrible.
I mean, Jack Noseworthy. No wonder he didn't have much of a career past this film. Like, who could take that name seriously?
Oh, that's his actor's name.
Yeah, that's oh, the actor's name. His character name is Ensign Justin. He might as well be
right,
Ensign Billy.
Right.
He's like the young member of the crew.
Yeah, Jack Noseworthy. You would figure he would have a better stage name.
Yeah, you got to think your agent would be like, your name is what?
All right. Well, moving on. Okay. Sorry, Justin, if you're listening, you know. But yeah, well, I mean,
yeah, sorry, instant Justin.
Yeah. So the I mean, but his character, I mean, winds up like killing himself. The other like girl or whatever, the one who played the doctor, that was the pilot. I'm looking at Kathleen. Yeah, Peters. The girl who played Peters, she kind of gets, like, duped into, like, falling to her death.
Yes.
So it, like, tricks her into, like, dying.
And again, much like The Shining, she sees, like, the ghost of her child who she misses. And the ghost child, like, leads her into killing herself. Again, it's all very haunted housey.
Right.
And I just want to go back. I believe Ensign Justin actually lives in the movie. Like, he's the one who gets stuck in the airlock and... And that's actually one of the better moments in the film was he gets caught in the airlock and he's about to get shot into the vacuum of space. And Lawrence Fishburne's character, whose name I'm blanking on, let's see, Captain Miller.
Yeah, Captain Miller.
Captain Miller actually basically goes out in a spacesuit and basically tackles him back into the spaceship in a very cool scene in the movie.
Yeah.
He basically talks him through how to survive in the vacuum of space, and then he basically tackles him back into the ship. One of the cooler moments in the film, in my opinion.
Yeah. That was really, really super cool.
Yeah.
And remember, I mean, Lawrence Fishburne, let's just talk about him for a second.
He's wonderful.
Plays Captain Miller. Now, this is two years before The Matrix.
Yeah.
I mean, but it's almost the same looking ship. Yeah. It's almost the same kind of looking.
It does look like the Nebuchadnezzar. You're right.
Yeah, it looks like the Nebuchadnezzar. The even the chairs and like the and even the characters are kind of like the same sort of like dirty, grungy, you know, sort of space movie. I mean, I just thought it was like really weird. I mean, is that may be part of the reason that like Lawrence Fishburne got cast in The Matrix? Or
it's
hard to say.
But he has such a good, he's such good with gravitas and making everything seem important and serious. And you know, if you want to follow, you believe him as a guy who would lead people.
Like, and he makes decisions, and you're just like, okay, all right.
Yeah. Like, he's truly heroic in this film, and he's really, I mean, he's really he's the best part of the movie, really. He is so great as the hero dealing with this unstoppable thing. Like, even when he feels overwhelmed, he's still compelling, interesting. You feel like he's always looking for a way to win.
Right.
And he doesn't feel selfish. The whole plot of his character is he doesn't want to have sacrifice any of his crew. He constantly puts the crew of the ship above himself.
Right.
Which makes him immediately heroic, which you don't normally see in these kind of movies.
Right.
Like, he's not scared. He's not trying to save himself. He's literally concerned with saving everyone else first.
Right.
And that's
well, at the end, he sacrifices, like, himself to save from this, like, portal or whatever from the other crew members that did actually survive.
Yeah, the few who do survive, he basically sacrifices himself in a very brave self-sacrificing moment to basically save them. And he also gets to punch Dr. Weir in the face a few times in a very heroic kind of 90s action hero sort of way.
Well, I mean, that just goes back to any sort of like hero movie where the two main characters have to have a physical confrontation.
Yes.
Right?
I think American audiences or Western audiences need a little bit of that, like, mano y mano, like, I'm going to solve it with my fist because I'm a man kind of thing.
Yeah, and the weapons that they use kind of get, like, thrown to the side, and then they're just left to duke it out, you know?
Yeah. But so I think for the most part, the film is not amazing. It's good. I like that it doesn't waste a lot of time. It kind of jumps you right into the story.
Right.
In fact, I'll go ahead and say this right now. My favorite thing about both these movies this week,
right,
90 minutes each.
Oh, I know. I looked at the time.
That was so satisfying.
Hour 30. One was an hour 39. I think The Fly was an hour 39, and Event Horizon is like an hour 35.
Yeah. And I was like, I can watch these in around 3 hours. Score.
I know. You can watch two movies in the same time that you can watch like one modern movie.
Yeah.
And these are two fantastic movies to watch.
Yeah. I felt like we got through these in the time it took us to watch The Cutting Edge last time.
You can kind of tell the special effects are a little dated, especially the digital effects. Especially like at first when like things are weightless, you're like, that doesn't look quite real. I think maybe, you know, we were still in the film era and you're still talking about like watching it on film. Yeah. And there was also VHS. This was before DVD. This is before you know, digital theaters.
Poor high def.
Right. I mean, and I, you know, maybe seeing it there, maybe it didn't look so kind of, you know, fakish, or maybe because we weren't used to that kind of thing nowadays, we can spot it easier.
I think that for the time it was made, it probably looked good.
Right.
But nowadays, the seams show quite a bit. At least with like the stuff that's obviously computer assisted, like the stuff flying through the air and things like that. I will say that the makeup effects are great. The costuming is really good. You know, let me see. I'll spring try to thought. The set design is beautiful. I mean, I said, it's unreal. Like it's completely unrealistic, but I mean, the sets are still beautiful.
Right.
Like the actual engine that rips the hole in the dimension is this cool spinning ball thing. That is just so cool to look at. I get why they wanted to use it a bunch and they showed it a lot because it looks really cool.
Yeah. I mean, it was kind of almost a character on its own in the movie, really. I mean, not just the ships, but that core part, right?
Yeah.
Because that was the driving force in this whole sort of like horror or whatnot.
So I'm curious. We've talked about things we liked about the movie. So what do you think it didn't quite work as well as it could have?
Well... like I said, you know, like you feel like Sam is sort of like haunted, but then after that, like everybody gets haunted, but then he winds up like the, you know, the main character. And then like, you never really see the characters that got away. They never really got haunted at all.
Yeah. And like, let's see, what's her name? The female pilot. She's like knocked out for a good chunk of the movie.
Right.
Like over the last 30 minutes, she's like unconscious for a while.
Right.
And I honestly thought I dozed off and missed her death scene until they showed her, like, passed out near the end of the movie. I was like, oh, there she is. I completely lost track of her.
Yeah, Cooper and, Stark. Yeah, Lieutenant Stark. Both of them, I mean, and they weren't even haunted by this whole thing.
Not really.
So, what, I mean... where are their inner demons? Where were their stuff? And also the other guy. Remember the other guy that like interpreted the Greek and all that kind of stuff?
Oh, yeah. Jason Isaacs, who plays DJ. He's really good in the movie. Jason Isaacs went on to have a really good... I mean, he's had a really great career. He's really good in the movie.
Right. Yeah, where were his demons?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And it's kind of his fault. Like if he had been better at Latin in the very beginning, they never would have ended up here.
Yeah,
but anyway, you hit on a point what I think is the biggest flaw with the movie, and I like I said, there's a lot of good in it, but there's too many characters.
Yeah,
for the story they're telling, there's too many people.
Well, I think in these type of movies, you know, horror movies, it's kind of like Jason movies, right? Where people get killed off, so you gotta like you know, like Justin for instance, midway through. You know, he gets put into stasis, so he's gone, you know.
Poor Jack Noseworthy.
Yeah, right. I mean, this person's going to work on this. I mean, we don't see Cooper for most of the film because he's working on the hull to try to get it fixed, you know. The same with the guy who's the pilot. Like, they're both working to patch up the old ship. So, I mean, it's just... I mean, I think you have to, like I said, you have to have the characters, even though you don't really get a lot of development with them, you still have to have them because they're all affected by, like, what's all going on.
Like, you're saying that they play a part.
Right.
And
I mean, they can't be in every scene. I mean, think about it. Their cast, if you think about regular movies, it's a very, you know, it's not that big. But the fact is, because you're on a ship, they have to be in a lot of scenes together.
Yes. I see what you're saying. I just think a few of these roles could have been folded into each other, like you could have combined a few of the characters.
Right.
But see, that's my biggest complaint. I felt there were too many characters. And Dr. Weir is obviously crazy from the moment the movie starts. So there's no real surprise when he has like his shining moment and he starts like, you know, really doing crazy things.
Yeah.
And of course, don't get me wrong, Sam Neill is great as Dr. Weir. Sam Neill is he's the best. I mean, really, him and Lawrence Fishburne, I could watch them read the phone book against each other and be really captivated by it because they're wonderful actors.
Yeah.
And he sells the material. Yeah. But you never quite, I never quite bought that he was anything but completely insane from the very beginning of the film.
Yeah.
And that's really, to me, that's a failing of maybe the script or maybe the direction.
Yeah, he automatically seemed like sort of a mad scientist from the kind of the get-go.
Yeah. And, it's the fact that, in a way, the fact that it is a slasher and that you do kind of have these characters just, who just exist to get messed up, it makes it hard to get involved with them. Like, you care about Fishburne's character. You character. You maybe care about DJ, you know, Jason Isaacs' character. Right. Or maybe the guy, a guy named Sean Petrie plays the pilot.
Right.
Let's see. His name was Smith. How did I forget Smith?
Yeah.
But yeah, you maybe care about those characters. Right. But no one else really gets a lot of development besides those characters.
Well, I think partially because maybe we start the movie kind of watching, you know, the ship and every, like getting on the Lewis and Clark ship and going to this thing through Dr. Weir's eyes, yeah, right?
Which is weird because he's the villain.
He's the villain, but we start off like with him. So yeah. I don't know if we're supposed to sympathize with him or we're supposed to be afraid of him. It's kind of like... I think part of it is just watching the transformation, a lot like The Shining, yeah. where we have, you know, this the you know, Jack Nicholson character totally and completely transformed by this, you know, haunted house kind of deal.
Yeah, and you follow with him too,
right?
So, I never really thought about the parallels between Event Horizon and The Shining. There are a lot of parallels there. But it's like Event Horizon's like the splatter version of The Shining, where The Shining goes for subtlety.
Right.
And Event Horizon goes for, hey, we're going to have these really, you know, slippery gore effects. And
where they go for the gore, they really go for the gore.
Well, you would think that unless you compared it to what we're going to talk about next, I think that's a perfect segue into David Cronenberg's The Fly.
The Fly. Now, this movie, The Fly, made in 1986... Okay, so this is 1 year after, like, Back to the Future. I mean, and the reason I say that is because, you know, on the brink of technology and computers and the home PC, I mean, you have to remember, you know, IBM and Apple, all these guys are starting in the early 80s. People are starting to work with computers, like, in their offices, and they're really sort of afraid of them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is sort of plays into their sort of fears about what can be accomplished with computers and about what, you know, what scientists and what people are actually working on and what's capable of what, you know, computers and things can do.
And it plays into another thing that Cronenberg does a lot in his films. I know you haven't seen a lot of Cronenberg films but this is really a good example of what he does. A lot of his films are about how the body is basically a rotting prison.
Yeah.
to put it, for a better word, we are trapped by our mortal forms, and it's a weird, disgusting system that is constantly dying. And he does that. He brings it up in a lot of his films. I mean, he brings it up in this one. He brings it up in Videodrome, in Existence, and other movies I'm blanking on at the moment, but it's a recurring theme throughout his work.
Right.
That the human body is a disgusting system that is constantly failing,
right? And he calls attention to it, and he makes you pay attention to that, right?
Yeah.
Like, we want to ignore that. We don't want to talk about, like, you know, our systems because it's kind of, you know. I mean, my wife is a nurse, so I mean, I know, you know, and everybody knows. I mean, everybody knows that, you know, our bodily functions are, you know, not pleasant. Anyway, let's talk about the kind of the synopsis of The Fly for those who maybe not have seen the movie, or maybe you have and you need a refresher. Jeff Goldblum plays a character named Seth Brundle. He meets the Gina Davis character who plays her character name is Veronica. She is a magazine writer.
A science magazine
writer. Science magazine writer. So he has developed, or is developing, I should say, a trans portal system where you go from, you know, one pod and you get, you know, hooked up and connected to this other pod.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he didn't say anything about wirelessly because there were, like, wires on the floor or whatnot.
Well, he was still working on it. It was an alpha testing, really.
Right. And, yeah, but that becomes kind of a thing, like, in the end. Like, you don't really you know, think about it. Well, he kind of, like, meets her at this art, you know, show or something like that, brings her back, shows the pods. And says, yeah, I can, you know, take something and, like, you know, it appears, you know, she sees them and thinks they're like phone booths.
Yeah.
And then, but anyway, the So, he can't do anything living. He can't do living things. So he realizes that the computer is really doing like an interpretation of whatever is there.
He refers to it as almost like a copy machine.
Right.
I can't remember the exact phrase, but he relates it to
facsimile a facsimile or something.
A facsimile like that, or he says Memorex.
Memorex.
Is it live or is it Memorex?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like it's reproducing or interpreting like whatever it's there. It's like it's synthesized. Mm-hmm. So anyway, he has to teach the computer about flesh. And so then he transports like a, you know, earlier he transports like a baboon, and then the baboon just like kind of turns inside out, which is really gross and gory.
Yeah.
But then once he like programs and codes the computer, it can transport the baboon from one pod to the other pod. Yeah. And then like,
I've got so many questions about this, by the way. But
yeah, I know. Going. I'm just going to keep going so we can kind of get through this and talk about the movie. But eventually he transports himself.
Yeah.
A fly gets in the pod. The computer doesn't know what to do with it. So it just fuses them together.
Mm-hmm.
And then he starts transforming into like a human fly,
mm-hmm.
like a human plus fly, I should say.
Yes. And I think that's a very concise way of explaining the movie. Basically, it's about this transformation from being a human being turning into this kind of monstrous hybrid. So let's talk about this movie. One thing I love about this movie, it jumps right into the story. Like, it starts...
Man, you just get dropped right in the middle. The opening scene
is them in the party.
And there's no character introduction or nothing.
Yeah.
It's just like boom, you're there.
Yeah. He's like, I'm working on something interesting. And she's like, oh, really?
That's the first line of the movie.
Yeah. And you know, if that movie was made today, there would be friggin' 40 minutes of him like in his workshop building the pods.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
No, it just starts off with, I'm going to... Something that's going to change the world or change the how we think about things.
Yeah, and I admire that so much that it just drops you in. Those things exist, and the movie just like, here's this thing, and we're going to go with it.
I know, because it's you just have to go, you figure out who they are pretty quickly. So, I mean, Cronenberg gives the audience a lot of credit for this.
Yes.
For not showing them all the other things that happen before you get to that point.
Yeah, basically, he introduces their characters to their conversation with each other, and he allows you to use context clues to figure out who they are.
Right.
And he basically explains the entire their entire personas in the first 5 minutes of them going to his laboratory for him to show her this thing he's already created and is just working to perfect. It's really economical. It's really well written, and it's really well filmed in the way that it just kind of just drops you in, but it doesn't overwhelm you. It's like it's paced so well,
right? Yeah, and you get to see like the gradual transformation of of Seth Brundle, you know, kind of becoming this man fly, you know, or what what he later refers to as Brundle Fly. And it's almost like watching somebody go through like the seven stages of grief or something like that.
In a way, yeah. It's about he at first is in denial about what's happening to him,
right? Right.
And then he's angry. He's angry about it. Then he's sad and defeated. Then he slowly accepts it. And the other parallel that I saw that was kind of interesting, it's almost like a superhero movie in the beginning. Like, he goes through this thing, and he gets these... He doesn't realize that it's messed him up at first. Like, when he first comes out of the pod after being fused with the fly, he has this crazy agility. He has all this energy. And he feels like this like almost like a Superman-type character. He doesn't realize what's happening to him yet, because he's just seeing all the benefits.
He thinks it's like some byproduct of being, you know, transported.
Yeah. And so... In a way, it's almost shot like an early superhero film. Like, he's doing like gymnastics, and they're showing how like ripped he is. And Goldblum was really ripped in this movie. Not to get him into a weird tangent.
I mean, and I watched those scenes really close. It really does look like him doing those.
Yeah, but
I don't think it's a body double.
But they're amazing gymnastics. There's some amazing gymnastics in that scene. I'd be shocked if it was Goldblum, but I guess I wouldn't be.
I think his first wife was a gymnast or something like
that. Really? Yeah. I mean, it's possible. He's definitely got a gymnast body, and also he has an amazing mullet. Let's not go. I'll talk about the amazing Jeff Goldblum mullet in this film.
Well, I think everybody is really sort of caricature. Oh, they're not even caricature 80s. These are like real 80s characters.
Yeah, it looks like, I mean, it looks like very natural 80s stuff. And I was telling you when we were off the air earlier, I never thought that a woman could make the 80s fashion look good. But Geena Davis really sells the 80s fashion, and she is beautiful in this movie.
I know. She's selling the big hair and the big lipstick and the
shoulder,
you know,
pads, and it looks good on her. I don't know what it is about it, but she looks really good in this movie.
I know.
Not to be all chauvinistic, but yeah, she's magnetic in this movie.
Yeah, she is. I mean, the story obviously draws parallels to people with, you know, diseases, like
cancer.
Debilitating diseases, yeah, like cancer or AIDS.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, and this is also during the middle of the big, you know, the AIDS crisis of the 80s.
Yeah, and I think there's a scene when he's going through his transformation where you see him at one point hobbling on canes.
Right.
And it really reminded me of footage you saw of people who were being debilitated by the AIDS virus in the 80s. How they had these people who were once young and kind of healthy just slowly get basically beaten down by these diseases. And obviously that's a very clear parallel that Cronenberg was trying to make, was he's fascinated by the idea of illness,
right,
and sickness. And basically Seth Brundle rots away in the film.
Right.
Like slowly as he's transforming, and in a way he's evolving into this fly, he basically starts losing body parts. And you think at first he's rotting, but really he's just losing things that are unnecessary to his new form. Like at one point his ear falls off.
Right.
And he, you know, he starts losing teeth, and he thinks that he's dying, but then he suddenly realizes, wait, I'm just becoming something different. And he starts to weirdly get gleeful about what's happening to him. Like he stops being afraid of it, he starts to become fascinated by it. And they put him in this wonderful prosthetic makeup where he's all kind of like bulbous and rotting looking.
Yeah.
But he's got this big Jeff Goldblum eyes, and he's got this big bulbous eyes of his, and he's just looking around all like crazy eyed. And it is super unnerving.
Yeah. And doing research for this movie, they had like one picture, and it wasn't very big. And I wish they had a bigger version, but it was like not a composite, but just like all the different versions of Seth Brundle from like when he's a man to like transform all his different and all the prosthetics and everything that he had to become till finally at the end where he's just got like a fly head.
Yeah, he really becomes like a truly animatronic creature that just looks like a fly.
Right.
As he basically completely sheds his mortal form in a really truly a molting scene where literally stuff just falls off of him.
Yeah.
And it's gnarly. The effects work in this movie is the only word for it is juicy. I mean, this movie is full of like liquidy, like fluidy effects work. Like as he's changing, as he's going through these transformations, it feels very realistic. It's all about like oozing fluids and like it's real. You don't want to watch this movie while eating.
No. And I mean the it's just really sort of to watch him go through this.
Yeah.
You know, to watch him go through this transformation is very saddening, you know?
Yeah.
It is extremely, extremely saddening. But then, you know, I mean, it's just an absolutely incredible movie. It's one of the movies when we first started talking about this movie, I'll be quite honest, I put off watching this movie for a long time. I did not actually watch it until yesterday. And I watched it yesterday because I like had to. I'm like, okay, we're doing the show. I got to watch it. I'm like,
okay,
I got to get ready.
See what he does for you, ladies and gentlemen.
I know. But no, I'm telling you, I saw this movie a long time ago, like when we had HBO, and I watched it a long time ago. And I remember just being very disturbed by all of the things that happened
to
him. Well, right. And I knew that was going to happen. I mean, I know, you know, kind of what's coming. I don't remember the exact sort of things that the order that things happened, but you know, cause it was a really long time. I was probably 13 when I saw this movie,
You don't want to watch this when you're going through puberty, so that's probably the wrong age to watch this.
Well, I mean, even so, I mean, you know, I watch movies on HBO all the time about, you know, like life and growing up or whatever. It was just another movie. But, yeah, but still, you're just like, what is this? But Jeff Goldblum is such an amazing character in this whole movie. I mean, this is what put Goldblum on the map as far as, like, being this sci-fi sort of hero.
Yeah. And it's a super brave performance for sure. Like, it is completely without ego. He looks disgusting through a large part of it, and he just seems to revel in looking weird. And
he completely, like, owns that role. Yeah. I mean, he completely just, like, takes it on, and it just shows the kind of character that, like, that Goldblum, you know, the kind of actor that Goldblum is, you know?
Yeah, he's one of he's a treasure. We use that phrase a lot, but Goldblum is a treasure. I mean, I'm so glad that we're alive in the time when he's still making movies.
Right. I mean, because he was committed to the role and to Cronenberg's vision, and, you know.
Yeah. And it's definitely out there, and I can't see a lot of actors being like, yeah, I want to play this part where my body falls apart, and I get, and you're going to show it in painstaking detail.
But when you watch him, when he goes from this kind of confident sort of scientist, you know, and then he goes in, you know, when he's transformed, how scared and how desperate and how just, like, absolutely maddening that it makes him.
Well, like
just the physical, but also just himself personally.
Yeah. Like, when he realizes that something is wrong with him, just the impotent fear he's able to convey. Like, he looks genuinely scared. It's not like an actor playing scared. Like, he really looks like that kind of quiet kind of scare that you get when you're afraid to go to the doctor.
Oh, right.
You know?
Oh, something that wasn't in my notes, and you said it earlier, and I should have said it when you mentioned it, but the scene where his ear falls off?
Yeah.
They didn't tell Gina Davis that was going to happen, so her reaction is actually kind of real. Like, oh, my God,
his ear gets shocked by it. And, again, that shot, like, you see it. Like, I mean, they don't cut away. I mean, his ear literally falls off on camera, and they're close up in it. And it's, again, to use a word, it is gnarly. I mean, that's the only word for it. I mean, true sense of the word.
Right. But, I mean, it is gory. I mean, he, like, has to regurgitate on his food to eat it, and...
Yeah.
And it's just gross.
If you have a problem with vomit, this may be not a movie to watch.
Like, no.
Like,
it's very
like
so
he
gross.
Just nonchalantly vomits on things.
Right.
Let's talk about how the movie kind of shifts as we go towards the end.
Right.
Because near the end, you find out that that Ronnie, Gina Davis's character, is pregnant.
Right.
And she's pregnant with Seth Brundle's baby.
Right.
And she's worried that it's going to be like this monstrous, like, fly baby.
Yeah.
So she goes to get rid of it. At the hospital, and then it becomes like almost like a 1950s monster movie, where, like, as you see her getting ready to go to the doctor with her old boyfriend, they cut to Seth Brundle on top of his laboratory looking down at them.
Yeah,
and he might as well have been Lon Chaney Jr. in The Hunchback of Notre Dame, you know, or like The Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah, and breaks in the window. It's very sort of comic booky type of stuff. Like, I was thinking of, like, you know, Batman or Superman, you know, something like that.
Well, what it made me think of was the old Universal Monster movies. Like, it's like something that you would see Frankenstein do. Like, he just smashed in a window and he grabs Ronnie and runs off with her.
Right.
Like the Wolfman or the Creature from the Black Lagoon. Like, and I kind of dug how it was all this kind of modern body horror, and suddenly it went to, like, this kind of 1950s sort of, like old school kind of style for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
And you even have the ex-boyfriend going to the laboratory with a shotgun to kill the monster.
Right.
And oh, does he fail at it pretty badly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, the ending was interesting. Because it doesn't leave you feeling like it doesn't give you good feelings.
No.
You feel that it's over, but then, you know, you're still like, you know, somebody has died. I mean, he basically, like, you know, Gina Davis has to, like, mercilessly, you know, kill, you know, like, this, you know, character because there's no real future for him.
Yeah. There's no going back.
There's no going back.
He's a monster.
Well, now that he's, especially at the end where he, you know, tries to, merge him and Gina Davis, or excuse me, Gina, her and Victoria.
Ronnie.
And, you know, Brundlefly is trying to fuse
with his lady.
With his lady and his lady's baby. And then, therefore, his idea is he'll be more human than Fly at that point. But then she breaks out because the
boyfriend, whose
the boyfriend shoots the cables. So then she gets out. And then so he opens the door and then, like, merges with the pod itself.
Well, like Brundlefly's trying to escape. And as he's trying to escape, that's when the teleporting sequence goes off. So he's, like, halfway out of the pod when it happens. And the machine reads the pod. So when he teleports, he's like Brundlefly, but he's got, like, metal parts sticking out of him.
It's like it's Brundlefly pod or Brundle pod.
Yeah.
And then so therefore there's really no future after that.
Yeah, I mean
he's
basically in pain. He can barely move, and they basically mercy kill him. Yeah. But like so, Gina Davis is traumatized. Her ex boyfriend is all messed up because he tries to play the hero, and Brundlefly basically messes him up.
Man,
Brundlefly basically catches this guy, throws him on the ground, and vomits on his hand using his corrosive fly vomit.
Do we have to talk about this?
Yes.
Okay.
And you watch his hand basically dissolve.
I'm shutting my eyes
in
right
painstaking
now.
Detail. And it doesn't stop there. So he dissolves his hand. You see it entirely in camera. It looks like it sucks. And then he, for some reason, he chooses to vomit on the guy's ankle next. And you literally watch the guy's ankle dissolve in camera and his foot come off.
I don't want to relive this, okay?
It's bad, ladies and gentlemen. It's bad. But it's an amazing practical effect.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I'm grossed out by you talking about it. Okay.
Yeah, it's gnarly.
It is
super juicy.
It's like really, you know, some of that scene though it reminded me like Indiana Jones when like the
Balak. When he melts.
Yeah, when he melts. Yeah.
Yeah. But that to me looks like a puppet. This stuff looked real. Like I've never seen a body dissolved by acid. But I have to figure out that's kind of what it looks like.
Yeah, and then when he was about to, like, regurgitate on his face, I was like, no! You know, inside I was. I wasn't really.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But, yeah, so this movie, it's so well acted. It's so well directed. But it has got some gross, gross effects.
It is gross.
That's a selling point for you or it's a deterrent.
Well, listen, I've got a lot of stuff to talk about this film, so we're just going to go ahead and jump into the kind of the facts about it. You know, as a recommendation, even though that it's gross and gory and it talks about like things in life that you don't want to talk about, you know, I walked away with that movie having a greater appreciation for life and for health. And for, you know, everything that I, you know, have in this world. I mean, you just feel so much luckier as a human being. Even though that it's completely far-fetched that this could ever happen, you know. But still, the reality of, like, you know, sickness and death and stuff like that are all, you know, very real.
Yes. And if you can handle the film, if you can deal with some of the more extreme aspects that we've talked about, the movie is incredibly worthwhile. I mean, like I said, it's such a well-made, well-acted film that I highly recommend it if you think you can deal with the things we've talked about today.
Right. All right, well, let's get into the facts. Let's get into the interesting facts about the both movies. First thing, Event Horizon. Michael Kamen did the score, which... He did the score of another movie that we talked about, or like, what did he do? The Last Boy Scout? Did he do that one?
Yeah.
But he also collaborated with the techno group Orbital.
I had forgotten about Orbital.
Orbital! It was a 90s
That's
thing.
That's so very 90s.
So 90s. Yeah. But they wanted to kind of the techno, they would kind of mesh the techno and the kind of classical. I mean, I thought, I really liked the music. And I really like the sound of the movie, too.
Yes.
There's a lot of interesting sound. I watched this with, like, headphones because I watch on my computer, and there's a lot of great sound effects. It sounds fantastic.
Yeah, the sound design in Event Horizon is top-notch.
Because there's a lot of, like, whispering and stuff, and you don't catch it a lot of times when you're watching, like, in the movie. You could really hear it, like, with headphones. Yeah. It's really eerie.
Yeah.
All right. Directed by Paul W.S. Anderson, which we already talked about. He's married to Mila Jovovich. Can you believe that?
That's why she's in all those Resident Evil movies. Yeah.
Multipass.
Yeah.
so, yeah, like I said, he was looking for a rated R horror after Mortal Kombat. He basically was handed this script, but It was basically aliens. Like, they went to the Event Horizon, and it was like aliens with tentacles. And they were like, he was like, no, I like this movie, but let me rewrite it. And he wrote it to have concepts of The Haunting and The Shining.
So I was wrong. See, here I thought I was unique, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, yeah. I mean, I stole The Shining from the nose. So I can't take credit for that.
That's okay. It's okay.
But yes, it's deliberate. Mm. Just know that, all right?
Well, then I feel very proud of myself because I picked up on that. I can understand subtext, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, there you go. So, yeah, it was kind of like this, the ship kind of being haunted. And I think that's because because it wasn't as developed, maybe that's kind of like the holes in it. Okay, so we talked about the gore and how gory both these movies are. Mm-hmm. But, Event Horizon. In test screening, okay, so it was even gorier. There's 10 minutes of footage that were cut out.
You can kind of tell, because there's a lot of fast cutting in Event Horizon.
In test screenings, members of the test audience fainted due to the amount of extreme gore.
Well, because you remember, test audiences don't often know what they're going to see. Like, I've been in some test screenings, and a lot of times you're
just... you don't have, like, a preview or, like, hey, I want to go see this movie, yeah. All right.
You're told you're going to, oh, I'm ready to see a science fiction movie with Sam Neill. That'll be awesome. I love Sam Neill. I love Jurassic Park.
Yep.
And then he's there cutting his flesh up and, you know, digging out his eyes. I mean,
yeah, you have no idea what to expect, right? Yeah. How gory, though, would we say? Real life amputees were used for special effects in scenes which Event Horizon crew members were mutilated, and pornographic film actors were hired to make the sex rape scenes even more realistic.
But those scenes are super quick. Like, I mean, like I didn't even realize that there were, like, rape scenes on them, because it's also...
Well, no. Okay, so to explain that, the video recording that I mentioned earlier, yeah. That video recording of the Event Horizon original crew destroying themselves in an orgy of simultaneous sex and murder.
Yeah, but in the film, just to clarify for people, it's hard to tell what's going on. It's cut very fast, so you just know, like, horrible things are happening. I find that
there's like a lot of screaming. There's like blood and gore. You see a lot of skin and blood, basically. Like, yeah. Very contrasty, the blood against the skin. You see a lot of that. That's all you really get.
It's just like a lot of effort for something that ended up being cut to ribbons, basically, is what I'm trying to say. Because it was cut pretty severely.
But yes, that's why it's mostly those scenes from the.
I can see why, because even those little flashes are pretty unsettling.
Right. And it's supposed to be like really. Horrible, like I said, simultaneous sex and murder.
It's intense. I mean, I don't know if I want to do. I don't know if I'd want to watch the uncut version of it.
There was planned interest in a DVD uncut version, but the footage that was cut out was never carefully restored, and it had gone missing. So
there's some weird like PA with it in his house right now.
So apparently, no. I guess they were just. I bet you somebody said, nobody needs to see this. This is horrible, and just got rid of it.
Yeah.
Went in the trash. So, yeah, none of that. They just made a special edition DVD instead, like a two special edition 2 DVD set. But, yes, the footage that was lost is apparently forever lost. The filming and editing was rushed by Paramount when it became clear that Titanic would not meet its projected release date. So Anderson was only given 6 weeks to edit. So because the whole point of the movie was that they didn't have anything, like Paramount didn't have anything during summer. Uh-huh. So they said, okay, you can do this movie, but you got to get it out by like, you know, this date or whatever.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the movie was actually a pretty decent sized hit for Paramount. Because I remember when it came out, this may just be my my limited perspective, but everyone I knew went to see it and seemed to like it.
The budget for the movie was $60 million. It made $26.7 at the box office.
They cost $60
million? Yeah. It was a big budget movie, man. But this is also the year of like Waterworld and like these big the budgets were getting like huger and huger because of, you know, like Jurassic Park and because, you know, people were spending.
Yeah, I guess I'm looking at it through like 2018 eyes. It doesn't look like it cost $60 million.
Yeah, I mean, you got to remember this is 1996. Yeah. When it was made, 1997. That's Probably 100 million today, I would think. Yeah, 2018.
It's just funny to look back on it because, like I said, I remember like all my friends being really big fans of it. I didn't see it videotape.
It became kind of a cult classic sort of after, you know, it hit the theaters, you know? So, so that's probably why. It was also released in like August, so it was like late summer.
Yeah.
So there wasn't really a big build up. And then by that time, like by later, like Titanic was released, and so it was like, it also got terrible reviews.
Oh, I can imagine that Ebert must have hated it.
He says that was a cue, and that was so awesome. He said, which we didn't even plan, the script creates a sense of foreboding and afterboding, but no actual boating.
He's such a clever man.
The best quote, though, came from the Washington Post critic Stephen Hunter. He wrote, "If you want to have that Event Horizon experience without spending the $7, try this instead. Put a bucket on your head, have a loved one beat on it vigorously with a wrench for 100 minutes, same difference, and think of the gas you'll save."
That's pretty savage.
He actually wrote that in a review for the Washington Post.
Yeah, critics sometimes will just be sad. I think that they just do that to amuse themselves sometimes. Like,
see how creative they can bash a movie?
Yeah. Because, you know, as someone who, again, I write film reviews, and eventually you get tired of saying movies just suck. You have to think of new and creative ways to think of how much you dislike something. But that's particularly savage. That's pretty mean-spirited.
Yeah. So the Entertainment Weekly gave it a B-. But, I mean, when has the Entertainment Weekly given a movie, like, really bad reviews anyway?
Yeah, it's true. You know, I'd say it's probably a C-plus, or if I was going to give a letter grade, a C-plus, B-.
Well, I mean, here's the kind of split, right? It has a 24% rating on Rotten Tomatoes, which is pretty terrible.
Yeah.
But it has a 61% audience score.
Yeah. People I know love it. Like, it's a very well-liked movie amongst people who like horror movies.
Yeah.
And science fiction films.
I mean, I know the plot has, a little bit of some holes. But really, I think it sort of captures, like, you know, horror, you know, and I mean, even though that it's gory, it is kind of scary. And it is, like, there's, you know, some science fiction about, like, being in these ships and traveling at light speed. And, I mean, that part is like really cool. And then, you know, you're like opening up this portal and, you know, I don't know. I mean, I like The Shining. I don't think that even though that it's like The Shining or The Haunting or, you know, Hellraiser in space. I mean, it is kind of a hodgepodge of all those movies, but I mean, it still is very entertaining. Yeah, and I still really like
it. It's worth watching again, if you're okay with the content that we've talked about.
Right,
and you want to watch a good fun movie to kind of spend some time with that won't blow your mind, but also won't really disappoint you. Event Horizon's a good like mid-level like science fiction horror film. It's kind of both. It's both a good mid-level science fiction film and it's a good mid-level horror film.
Right,
but it doesn't really aspire to be too great or too awful. It's just kind of right down the middle, and that's okay.
Yeah, and well, maybe that's what critics don't like about it. Like, it's not a science fiction film, like, completely, and it's not a complete like horror film. I don't know. Maybe they thought it was too ambiguous. I don't know. I thought it was great, and I thought that, you know, I mean, Alien and Aliens were both what, rated R, right? Mm-hmm. They're rated R, like, kind of science fiction movies. I mean, these are completely kind of different from both those movies, but still, I think that it's, you know, because it's a completely sort of different concept of the horror, but still,
it's less subtle than Alien for sure. It's not subtle at all. It's very it's very 90s.
Yeah,
it's very like techno music and like in your face, and you know, it's the Mountain Dew of horror. It's
right.
It's all hopped up on caffeine.
Yeah, and maybe I liked it more when I was like younger and in college, and was just like, oh, this is really cool, you know. But anyway, I still really enjoyed it. And
I think it's good. I just think it suffers in comparison when you compare it to The Fly.
Okay.
Yeah.
So The Fly It actually is a remake of a 1958 film of the same name by George Langdon.
Mm-hmm.
In that film, the director then discovered the story in a Playboy magazine. And then the head of Fox subsidiary, basically, it was released. The head of Fox subsidiary B-Movie Studio Regal Pictures and was released as an official Fox film, but not under the less prestigious Regal banner. So the original short story of The Fly was they were a married couple.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of like worked in the basement on this thing. And then she winds up having to kill him, like mercilessly kill him. And then the detectives have to come like figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
And then he can't speak. He has to like type out on a typewriter, like what he wants to say or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think that there were some original scenes from this version of The Fly that did the same thing, but I don't think that they really worked or conveyed.
Like, it's been a long time since I've seen the original, but there are definitely some homages to the original Fly in Cronenberg's version.
Right. He basically rewrote it. You know, he took the concept and rewrote it. And he wrote it, I mean, where he gets a co-writing credit.
Yes. Well, it's definitely if you know Cronenberg's filmography, this is a Cronenberg movie through and through. I mean, he makes certain kinds of films, and The Fly fits right in there. It feels like his work, you know, 100%.
It won the Academy Award for Best Makeup.
The makeup is stellar.
It is the only film directed by Cronenberg to win an Oscar. So, it grossed $60.6 million at the box office.
Was it a hit?
Yeah, so $9 million. It was made for $9 million and grossed $60 million.
Wow, that's really, it's such a dark. It's hard to imagine like this movie being a big hit, but that's a big hit in 1980s.
Well,
dollars.
You have to think about it. They didn't have very many They didn't really have a lot of like places where they shot. You know, it was shot mostly in a studio. They didn't have to do a lot of like location shooting or not a lot of sets to build.
But $60 million in 1980s money, that's a lot of money, you know?
I know.
That means it was a big film. And, you know, I remember being a kid seeing the advertising for it, and I remember thinking the advertising was quite, you know.
I mean, especially for a rated R.
There's a lot of it, you know.
Especially for a rated R film.
Yeah. Like, the commercials were played a lot. I remember them being very creepy. They were all centered around the pod, and, like, the door would open and the smoke would pour out, and you'd see, like, a fly hand come out of it. It scared the crud out of me when I was a kid.
Cronenberg was not the almost not the director.
Oh yeah?
Yes. So apparently he was working on Total Recall to be the director for Total Recall.
Wow. So speaking of merch movies that you wonder what that would be like, yeah.
Well, apparently things were sort of falling apart, but at the same time the producer got in Robert Bierman to come direct The Fly, but then his daughter got into like a car crash or something like that and had to back out of being the director. Well, the producer found out that things were falling apart, you know, with Cronenberg on Total Recall. So he basically, they quickly offered and got Cronenberg to do The Fly. Cause I mean, it wasn't the magic without Cronenberg.
Yeah, the movie would not have been what it was without Cronenberg's very unique style.
Right. So the differences in the script is mostly that Cronenberg's version is a flyman creature slowly developing a disease versus transforming into the fly from the original like movie The Fly. This also, you may know, there's probably not a lot of stuff on this movie that I'm going to trump you with that you didn't
know.
You never know. But you didn't know that, you know, that Cronenberg almost directed Total Recall.
I did not.
Okay. Did you know that The Fly was produced by Mel Brooks?
I did.
You did know that. Okay.
I did.
So that's what I thought, because we love Mel Brooks. But
I'm a huge fan of Mel Brooks here at the Video Culture Podcast.
So the producer, well, I guess, I don't know if he was, because he's the executive producer, right? Mm-hmm. He just like put up the money.
Yeah.
The real producer, Stuart Fonfield, He convinced the studio to distribute if he would find money to make it. So he went to Mel Brooks because of he collaborated with them before on The Elephant Man. So Mel Brooks said, yeah, sure, that's great. And he is the one that convinced Cronenberg to, you know, just take it as far as he wanted.
Yeah.
To just like, you know, you go do you, man. You go make it whatever needs to be made. Yeah.
'Cause Mel Brooks actually is a big film fan. Not many people talk about that, but Mel Brooks loves movies and he believes in artistic freedom. So I've actually heard him speak quite passionately about artistic integrity when it comes to filmmaking. So he's not just all jokes.
Yeah, sure. I know. And I know there's another podcast that people probably like really love, which is like, you know, how did that get made or whatever. And
we don't mention other podcasts on this podcast. we're going to bleep that out.
No, we're all friends here. No, I think that, my point is that on that, you know, as much as we think about movies, that like, how in the world did this crappy movie get made? You know, to me, it's more enlightening to figure out how did these great movies get made, because a lot of times they don't have artistic freedom. A lot of times the movies that are bad is it because you have too many cooks in the kitchen
you can't do that,
right? And you have the studio playing quarterback, you know, telling the director what to do.
Yeah. And really that's what makes The Fly wonderful, is it is so, you know, just it's so committed to itself. You know, it's so committed to its concept, almost to the point of being truly unsettling. And that's all because they didn't have to worry about money. They had Mel Brooks basically financing it. They could just do what they wanted to do and tell the story they wanted to tell, and they didn't have to second guess it.
Well, and because of that not second guessing, I think all of the characters in the movie are like, they're all committed to the story. It's not that they're committed to, well, I'm going to make this a great performance, or how am I going to make this scene about me, you know, or how am I going to do this? Like, they're not, and they're not phoning it in.
Yeah.
You know, they're doing it for the sake of, like, you know, let's make the director's vision, or let's get this point across, like, really great. Like, the scene that is in the coffee shop, that was Jeff Goldblum's idea to help develop the character more.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That whole scene.
Yeah. Where he's just pouring sugar into his coffee over and over again. And,
yeah. Yeah. And being, you know, like all,
just,
you know.
Just all jittery and excitable. Yeah. I mean, bug-eyed and Jeff Goldblum-like.
I know. And it works. And that's the kind of thing that happened. I mean, he didn't come up with that scene of like, oh, let me do something like really fantastic. He wanted to help develop the character.
Yeah.
So where was I at? I lost my place.
Mel Brooks producing the movie.
Brooks came up with the famous line, be afraid, be very afraid.
Hmm.
So the one that Gina Davis used.
Which really, that's a great poster tagline. I mean.
Yeah. I mean, because it sums up the whole thing.
Yeah. And it's hard to. That's such a phrase that's become so ubiquitous. And like, it's so such a part of pop culture that you don't even think about how what a great line that was at the time to sell a movie, you know?
Mel Brooks didn't want people to know that he was involved, because he didn't think that people would take the movie seriously.
Same thing happened with The Elephant Man. He tried to keep his name hidden from the credits.
Right.
Which is real. Again, you got to really respect that. Anything to make me love Mel Brooks more.
Right.
Humility.
Right. Because, I mean, this is a guy who's known for making Blazing Saddles.
Yeah.
You know, he's known for making, like, you know, fart jokes. And so he didn't want to,
But just really great fart jokes. Let's just clarify that. Really great fart jokes.
I use that, like, that's probably the worst example. But you know what I mean.
Yeah,
I mean, his movies are really sort of
silly.
Very, very goofy and fun, and we love them for those reasons. But yes.
He doesn't want people going into a movie thinking they should laugh at it.
Right. Goldblum was almost not cast due to his bankability, quote unquote.
Which is mind-blowing because he's so great.
Right. Well, one of the other reasons why is because they were like, oh, they got to have a lot of prosthetics, so don't get somebody with a big nose and big ears.
Yeah, he's got both those.
Oh,
things,
let's go get this Jewish kid, you know, this tall Jewish kid, you know. Other people that almost were in this movie, John Keaton. or John Keaton, John Lithgow and Michael Keaton.
Okay. Yeah, the idea of John Lithgow and Michael Keaton
combined. I just fused those two together. See, that they got fused together.
We are on theme tonight, ladies and gentlemen. We are on theme tonight. But yeah, I can't.
John Lithgow. Can you imagine John Lithgow and Michael Keaton?
I can't imagine Lithgow. I really can't. I can imagine Keaton, and the movie's not as good.
Yeah, this is true.
Because something about Goldblum in his, like, he's got this real lanky, spindly frame that just kind of works for someone turning it into an insect. Like, I imagine the scenes of him, like, walking on the wall. I imagine the scenes of Brundlefly walking on the ceiling, and I picture Keaton doing that, and it just seems ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, he was, you know, Beetlejuice, and he was, what was the other movie that he was in?
Batman, Mr.
No,
Mom.
I know he was in Batman. The other recent movie that he was in, where he plays a Batman type character.
Oh, Birdman.
Birdman and Batman.
Yeah, but I can't see him selling the transformation like Goldblum did. I can't see either of those guys doing it. I mean, and John Lithgow, he's a great actor. Michael Keaton, wonderful actor. But to me, intrinsically, Jeff Goldblum just feels right. Like, that's how great he is in this movie. I can't imagine anyone else doing it and making it work half as well.
Well, I will say this. Lithgow auditioned, right? Which means we don't know. But Michael Keaton turned it down.
I could see why.
Yeah. But, I mean, he was more sort of like bankable at the time, I guess.
He was Mr. Mom, yeah.
He was Mr. Mom. He was in Gung Ho.
Yeah.
Like, he was kind of getting a name for himself.
He's like, I know Ron Howard. I'm not vomiting on people.
I know Ron Howard. I know Obi Taylor. Back off. All right. back to reality. Okay. It was actually Goldblum's idea. Sorry. Okay.
Okay.
Opie Cunningham. All right. It was basically Jeff Goldblum's idea to cast Gina Davis. They were boyfriend and girlfriend at the time.
Oh, that lucky.
They didn't meet on set. They were together before the movie.
And they have wonderful charisma in the movie, and like, and they look like a couple. So I mean, that makes so much sense.
I love the role reversal of how she sort of courts him.
Yes,
fantastic.
Like he's the wilting flower, and she's sort of like the take charge, like, you know, aggressor, and it's very cool.
Yeah,
and she sells it wonderfully. She's like, again, we didn't talk much about Gina Davis' movie, but she is great. Yeah. Gina Davis does not get enough credit for being as great as she is.
My favorite scene is Gina Davis's is when she comes home to her apartment and her ex-boyfriend is like taking a shower. And she's like, what are you doing here? Like, you don't need to be here, blah, blah, blah. And then so he's like in the shower. And so she like flushes the toilet.
Yeah.
Which basically, I mean, we don't get like told. This is another idea where Cronenberg has to give credit to the audience to know that if you flush a toilet and the hot water is going, there's going to be no more cold water and it's just going to be scalding hot, you know, out of the shower.
Well, and the whole scene actually is again Cronenberg giving the audience credit because you don't know that guy's her boy. You meet that character earlier in the movie and you don't know he's her ex boyfriend until that moment.
Right, that's another thing, too.
And again, it goes back to the Cronenberg, just trusting the audience to be able to keep up and use visual clues to understand the story. Yeah, again, such a well-made movie. And
It's so fantastic how he put those two together. They also, Gina Davis and Jeff Goldblum also worked. Here's the other weird thing that I found out. That because Gina and Jeff were, you know, together before this movie, Gina is apparently a really great, like, sort of inept mimic. So she was kind of doing Jeff in some of the scenes. She was kind of, like, mimicking his, like, sort of linguistic, what did it say? Like this, you know, here's what Cronenberg said. I'll just read the quote. Jeff has a very strange and infectious way of speaking and moving, so we had to disconnect Gina and Jeff for the sake of the movie. Because Jeff Goldblum has a way of talking, and
He's got that unique cadence. It's not like walking, but it's just as unique as walking.
You know, it's kind of like walking a little bit.
But it's not really. It's like a jittery, faster version
of
that.
It is.
And it's like he's always a little bit caffeinated. And he's you know, constantly, he's like, he's button to use a flyer. It's like he's buzzing. And it's fascinating, interesting. If you listen to it enough, you'll want to talk like Goldblum. So I totally get what he's saying. Mm-hmm. You hear it enough, you kind of want to pick up that pattern because it's fun to listen to.
It's infectious. That's the best way that I heard it. They also the two of them also starred together in Transylvania 65,000,
which is a really underrated movie that I would recommend to people.
And Earth Girls Are Easy.
I forgot about Earth Girls Are Easy. Yeah. But yeah,
that's an odd movie.
Transylvania 65,000 is an incredibly odd movie. Tell me about two odd films. Like,
right.
We may have to get back. We may have to pair those together for a future episode down the line.
Yeah, Jeff Goldblum, Gina Davis, and do those two movies together.
Make a note.
Future podcast
episode 45.
Whatever. So there are some deleted scenes and alternate endings. There was a scene that had to be cut, like this incredibly gory scene that is called the monkey cat scene. Have you heard about this?
I want to say I have, but I do not remember.
So Brundle uses the telepods to merge an alley cat and their surviving baboon together and attempt to find a cure for his condition. However, the resulting monkey cat creature comes out terribly deformed, attacks Brundle, and then Brundle beats the two-headed creature to death with a metal pipe.
That sounds really, really out there. Like, in a movie full of out there stuff, that's really out there.
So, yeah. So, like, there are people that... and then there's even more. After this happens, he's so disturbed, he scales the wall, and is sitting there, like, contemplating things. And then he has this, like, sharp pain in his left side. And while he's checking things out, he accidentally slips off the roof onto a metal awning, and then out from his abdomen, a small fly-like leg emerges from his torso, and then he was so horrified, he amputates it with his teeth.
Wow.
So that whole scene, I don't know what caused it, whether the beating of the pipe or like whatever, but there was somebody from the test audience that basically vomited.
Well, it's amazing because the whole movie is so extreme. Now I kind of want to see it just to see like what was too extreme for a movie that's extreme as extreme as the
I think it's on the special edition DVD probably when we get to
do it. I will go home and look at YouTube and see if I can find that. Maybe not while I'm eating, but at some point.
Be prepared with a strong stomach.
Yeah.
But I think the scene was cut mostly because, a test audience doesn't like it, and it doesn't really show Brundle in a very sort of positive light,
Well, and it doesn't really move the story.
It's not very humane.
Well, it's not humane. No, what I was talking about was the movie is so economical and it's so well paced. It also doesn't progress the story forward any.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, the movie just keeps progressing. Like, each scene leads into the next, and it's very economical. And that'd be a weird digression.
And then it gets worse. This is in the script. This is in the movie. They never really filmed the scene.
Okay.
But after amputating his insect leg, the script additionally called for Brundle to encounter a homeless woman in the alley upon whose face he would vomit and subsequently consume.
Which I guess they do a callback to it in the end when he's about to vomit on the boyfriend.
Yeah. However, this is written out before filming. But an actress had already been hired to play the bag lady. Mm. But the sequences on the DVD, they talk about.
Yeah, that sounds like, again, it makes Brundle, I think, too unsympathetic at that point in the film, I'm sure.
All right. And there's four, like, alternate epilogues. I won't go into, like, all of them because we're already, like, way too over on this. But basically, it adds more to the end of the story, right? Okay. So there are two that basically, like, where Brundle Fly or Brundle Pod, like, tries to get at Stathis, and then Stathis. He just, like, falls over, like, dead. But then after that, like, what happens with Veronica, like, after? Like, there's an epilogue scene where they're married and she awakens from another nightmare, which she gives birth to Brundle's child. But then she falls back to sleep and dreaming of a beautiful baby with butterfly wings from a cocoon flying off a distant light source.
That's terrible.
Yeah. Then there's another scene where, because people didn't like Stathis, he was kind of a, like a...
He's really unlikable.
Unlikable. Where she, waking up alone and in her own bed, having this butterfly dream, right? Mm-hmm. And clearly pregnant with Brundle's baby. There's one where she has the dream and not pregnant with Brundle's baby. And then there's another one where they're in, Veronica and Stathis are, like, much the same one, but without her being pregnant. And instead, Stathis reassures her that there is no baby. She falls asleep and has a butterfly dream.
All those are terrible. The movie, the way the movie ends is way better. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just like this kind of a cold ending.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you have like the finale and then that's it. There is no finale. I mean, yeah. It's just like the end.
It has the abruptness of the end of like American Werewolf in London, where you know, the monster's dead. Everyone who's kind of everyone's left kind of dealing with this trauma of what they've gone through, and it's just done.
Yeah.
You know, and I love the ending. I love how abrupt it is, because there's no happy ending to this story. No. I mean, it's all terrible.
I mean, it's just like death, really.
Yeah.
Well, this movie was very well received, unlike the previous movie we just talked about. Roger Ebert says, "The Fly is one of the very few movies that give me a sense of hesitation as soon as the credits appear. I've owned a couple of home video versions since its release 20-some years ago, according to the technology in favor, but I doubt I've played them more than a handful of times." So he kind of thinks the same way I do. He didn't want to watch it.
Yeah.
"For such a well-made, entertaining movie, this is particularly odd, but among the great horror flicks, this hits you a little bit below the belt, but for enjoyment's sake."
Yes. It goes back to, it plays in some very dark themes, but it is so good.
Gene Siskel loved it.
Really? Siskel normally hates stuff
like this. "As slimy and as grotesque as some of its special effects become, The Fly is a far superior horror film to the top grossing film in America of late, Aliens."
he couldn't just like one movie. He had to like one movie and then tear down another more popular film.
He's such a backhanded compliment guy.
Siskel was such a jerk. Rest his soul. But
all right, so the 91% rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah, of course it's right. It's so good.
Yeah, and I mean, this is really like the highest rated, probably Rotten. I mean, it is the highest rated Rotten Tomatoes movies that we have.
Wait. You're so saying far. It's more well liked than 18 Again?
There's not many movies. What was that? That one only had like a 18%, I think. I can't remember. I have to look it up. I don't remember what approval rating that it had.
I guarantee it wasn't high. I'd be shocked if it was 18. That'd be a weird bit of synergy. But
no, I mean it has an 83% audience rating, but I think that goes back to the pleasantriness of it, right? Like, it's not something like Empire Strikes Back where I want to watch over and over again.
Yeah. Like, it's not pleasant, but it's so very well made and good. Like, I keep going back to that, but it's such a weird thing because it's very violent and gory and gross, but yet it's really watchable. It's such a weird thing in that respect, you know?
All right, well, we're way over time, but we still have to. What are some other great sci-fi horror movies suggestions for our audience?
Well, as far as sci-fi horror films, I'm going to recommend another David Cronenberg film. I'm going to recommend Videodrome, which stars James Woods and Deborah Harry of Blondie. And it's all about, again, it's about, you know, the weakness of the body and the obsession with television and media.
Uh-huh.
And I don't want to say too much about it, but it plays into a lot of the same themes of the Fly. And it's got one of the greatest taglines of any movie: long live the new flesh.
Right. Yep.
And so that's one movie. And the other movie I'm going to recommend is not a horror sci-fi movie, but it is a horror action film. And it stars Cooper from Event Horizon. It's called Dog Soldiers.
Okay.
It's about a British military group who's out of maneuvers, and they run across a pack of werewolves. It's directed by a guy named Neil Marshall. It's a little British film.
Uh-huh.
It's a little bit like Predator, a little bit like The Howling. It's really fun. Not many people know about it. Mm-hmm. And again, it stars the same guy who played Cooper from Event Horizon.
I love that guy, man. I thought he had.
Yeah.
We mentioned it, and we didn't even talk about it, but I thought he had great, sort of comic relief. And
yes, he's good. His name is Sean Pertwee, I believe is how you pronounce it. But he is such a great character actor. He's one of the guys who pops up in things. And you're like, hey, it's that guy. I love that guy.
I got his name right here. The medical doctor pilot, Richard T. Jones.
No. I'm sorry, that's not Cooper. I'm sorry, it's the pilot who played the pilot.
Oh, Sean. Pertwee.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's the pilot.
His name is Smith.
Yes, Smith. You're correct.
So such generic names in Horizon. But yes, he plays Smith.
Smith Cooper.
At least I missed it up here at the very end. But yes, Dog Soldiers, it's about basically a British military outfit versus like howling-style werewolves, like big, like wolf-like werewolves that walk on two legs. Very cool movie, good effects, fun. Like a real good popcorn film.
All right. So there you go. So your two movies, once again, just tell them one more time.
Our Videodrome by David Cronenberg.
Right.
And Dog Soldiers by a man named Neil Marshall.
All right. Well, there you go. And if you like Lawrence Fishburne being as a pilot in a ragtag group of people in the sci-fi fiction, you can always watch The Matrix. If you get nostalgic for that.
Yeah, a little small sci-fi science fiction film called The Matrix. Yeah.
Little side project.
Yeah, if you guys have never heard of it, it's I think it had.
I think it's a franchise now, right?
Is it a franchise? I did not know.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks again for listening to our show, and try to stay, keep yourself sane out there, watching these horror movies, and for those that really love them. I mean, I'm not a big horror, like movie guy, but I mean, I think I kind of get it now, and like how, sort of like good you feel sort of after it, because you know that this is, you're not part of that or whatever.
It's like a roller coaster. I got to say, I'm proud of you for coming along on this journey with me this week.
Yes.
I promise you, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to go much lighter after these last two heavy weeks of films.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But we wanted to make sure that we're including all of these sort of cult classic genres, and really, really enjoyed this week. Two great films. One really awesome film. And
one pretty good one.
Yeah. one pretty good one.
Which is much better than two bad ones.
or kind of a good one and kind of a bad one. So, well, thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Yeah, I'm Matthew Estrie.
And I'm Ryan Acree.
Go watch some movies, guys.
Thanks for checking out this episode of Video Culture. You can check us out on Twitter at VideoCulture2.
That's the number 2 for two guys talking about movies like Ryan and myself.
And you can also check us out on Facebook. Just search for Video Culture Podcast.
Also, be sure to stop by our official website, video-culture.com. There we have the entire show archives, as well as articles about film.
Yeah, so check us out. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, come hang out with us, talk movies. Did you like the show? Do you hate the show? Do you like or hate the movies we talked about? Let us know. Come chat with us, and let's all watch movies together.
I think you're making a mistake. I think you really want to talk to me.
Sorry, I have 3 other interviews to do before this party's over.
Yeah, but they're not working on something that'll change the world as we know it.
They say they are.
Yeah, but they're lying.
There is a limit. Even to the imagination.
Human teleportation, molecular decimation, breakdown, and reformation is inherently purging.
Where our greatest creations meet our deepest fears.
Something went wrong, Seth. When you went through, something went wrong.
You are about to go beyond that limit.
Those weird hairs that were growing out of your back, I had them analyzed. But they were definitely not human.
If you saw how scared and angry and desperate he is...
I'm sure Typhoid Mary was a very nice person, too, when you saw her socially.
No!
You're afraid to be destroyed and recreated, aren't you?
You're changing, Seth. Everything about you is changing.
Oh, no. What's happening to me? Am I dying?
I want to know what's going on.
What does the disease want?
wants to turn me into something else.
Oh, no.
A fly got into the transmitter pod with me that first time when I was alone.
Don't go back to it.
Could be contagious.
I'm afraid.
Don't be afraid.
No. Be afraid. Be very afraid.